Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here with yet another episode of the Thriving Farmer Podcast. And today my guest is Hannah Breckbill, who is the co-founder of Humble Hands Harvest, a worker-owned organic farm in Northeast Iowa. Now in her 12th season alongside her team, Hannah champions no-till farming and community-connected land ownership, reflecting their commitment to sustainable food systems and local community nourishment. Hannah, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So give us a little bit of a background on how you started in sustainable agriculture.
Yeah, I grew up in a city and was not connected to the land or farming at all until I went to college. I had a math major. I was very abstract. And at some point in college, I just realized, wow, I want to do something real in the world. I want to do something that impacts people. And that's tangible and shows results. And so I ended up finding farming and kind of experimenting with farming out of college and just stuck with it. It was kind of an accidental thing, but I really am so glad to be able to be part of making the world better in a like tangible way through farming.
Absolutely. Now, did you intern first? Did you just start your own farm? How did you get into it?
Yeah, I started out interning on a farm in Texas, and then I soon moved up. I followed my college girlfriend up to Decorah. She had a job at Seed Savers, and okay. I found a different job on a vegetable farm here. And that was in 2010, I guess. And then I worked on that vegetable farm for a couple of years before I found an opportunity to rent some land. And the folks who were renting to me had kind of a built-in market. They had grass-raised meat, and they were sending their meat up to the Twin Cities and they had room in their trucks for some vegetables to go to those same restaurants. So that was my start of Humble Hands Harvest in 2013. And so then I rented land for about 4 years as a sole proprietor, Humble Hands Harvest, until I was able to access land ownership and also add Emily Fagan, my co-farmer, to the business.
Very cool. So talk to me about the difference between, obviously, we were renting for a while, that experience, compared to now, obviously, owning land and being able that much more ownership of the land.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel really grateful to the people who offered up land for me to borrow for several years. And at the same time, I didn't have a very secure or any kind of long-term lease with either of them. So that meant that I wasn't able to invest in any kind of infrastructure that was meaningful to be able to make my farm actually kind of level up. I wasn't even able to invest in soil building, really. It didn't make sense to throw a bunch of compost on some land that I didn't know if I was going to be there long term. And I was getting really excited about trees and planting trees and agroforestry crops. So all of that kind of led me toward, wow, it's really important to have some kind of long-term access. Whether that's ownership or not, didn't really matter to me at the time. And I wasn't actually expecting to gain ownership, but it felt really important to have some kind of permanence. And I realized that farming was not going to be sustainable for me unless I had people to farm with me as co-farmers and also permanent land access.
So. Correct. So then talk to us a little bit about the journey to get your own or farm your own land. Was that, how long did that take? And kind of talk to us a little bit about the farm property.
Yeah. So the property that we're on now, and that we have full ownership of is 22 acres. Mm. So not huge, but also bigger than just what we grow for vegetables. So we have 2 acres of vegetables on the 22 acre property. And then we graze the rest of it with sheep, and we've been planting chestnuts, apples. We have various orchards around the farm. And yeah, 10 years ago, that farm was a hay field, or actually a cornfield. The owners of it were, had retired, and were getting rid of their land and were posting it up for auction. But then the neighbor up the road from them, was really worried about what would happen, who might buy it if it went up for auction. He was worried about hog confinement operators coming into the neighborhood, that kind of thing. And so what he did was he organized a group of about 20 people to all pool their money and buy it outright before it went to auction from the owner. And so this group, they formed an LLC, and they basically collectively owned this land. So the first thing that they did was they put it into hay. They found a renter who would do that. And then over the course of 3 years, I actually had a share of that LLC from the beginning. It was at the time that I was renting land. Mm-hmm. And over the course of 3 years, I was able to kind of convince that group that they could sell to me. And we could have a diversified farm there. So that felt really, it was just this like amazing opportunity, mm-hmm, very mm-hmm. serendipitous. But over the course of those 3 years, of course, the hay renters didn't put any chemicals on. So we were able to certify organic from the beginning, mm-hmm. Which was a really nice thing. Another thing that I wasn't really able to do on the rented land that I had.
So. Correct. So then when they convinced to sell to you, did they, you just go to a conventional loan to purchase it, or they owner finance? How did that transition work?
Yeah, it was owner financed. And so basically what happened is that I had a share from the beginning, and then anytime that I had enough money or that Humble Hands Harvest had enough money, we bought another share from another person. And so I accumulated enough shares at first to buy, the land had already been subdivided. So I was able to take 8 acres and put it in my name. And that's what enabled me to start putting in infrastructure, like getting the well, getting the electricity, correct, everything like that. So that is what, actually made it possible to start. And then since that time, we just gradually bought people's shares out of this LLC until we owned the entire LLC. And then the land is in our name now.
Very cool. Yeah, that's a really cool way. There, land access is such a huge problem for new and beginning farmers. It took us 3 years to find our piece. And our piece is great in that we're in the city with a lot of traffic, but our water challenges are astronomical. We have high aluminum. So, and that was 3 years. It's a challenge for a lot of folks. Talk a little bit about organic. So you said you're certified organic. What does that mean to you? And, talk a little bit about, kind of your practices.
Yeah. So we've been certified organic from the beginning of our time on this land, and that feels really good to be able to be part of that kind of verifiable, certifiable movement of being able to say, like, we abide by these practices and we do good things with our soil, with our farm. We're extra excited, really, to be part of the Real Organic Project, which feels like it has a little more of that movement spirit and a little less of the bureaucracy of the USDA process.
Yes.
So obviously we have to do both. We have to be USDA certified in order to be Real Organic certified. But I love to be part of movements and part of wider efforts to make our landscape better. And so it's just fun to be able to claim that.
Yeah. So then with the Real Organic, is that something, do they do a farm inspection? Is there a paper, a paper like application?
It's actually very simple. It's, you do an application online. If you're already USDA certified organic, you do an application online. It takes maybe 15 minutes to complete. And then you can, they do send out an inspector, at some point. But they don't, it's not like a USDA inspection where you have to like go through your records and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's more just, they see the farm, they ask questions about your operation. They, things that are important to Real Organic people is that you're, growing in the ground. So it doesn't certify hydroponic operations. And then also, they ask questions about your labor practices, which I think is really important and relevant, in our food system.
Yes.
Both of those things, I'm really proud to be able to certify with them.
Absolutely. You just mentioned labor. Let's go into that, because I believe you're a worker-owned farm, right?
Yeah. So we're a worker-owned co-op, and that started with me as a sole proprietor really wanting at least one person to join me and be equally invested in the business, like as emotionally. So not just someone who's working for me and, you know, clocks in and out and whatever, but someone who actually, it matters to them whether the business is succeeding and profitable and that kind of thing. So that's why I added Emily to the business as a partner in the business. And after a year of her and I working together, we kind of solidified, our operating agreement. And we used a lot of kind of, templates and inspiration from worker-owned co-op, information. Our method of being a worker-owned co-op is that our labor is what counts for our patronage and for how much we own of the business, and not actually our financial inputs, necessarily. Although each of us, what we've put in financially, we will get out financially, when we retire or something like that. So we have structures for both onboarding and offboarding, to keep people's kind of financial, input secure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so right now it's still just me and Emily, and we've created an onboarding process where, we hire about 2 employees a year right now, a full-time, seasonal employees. If they work for us for 2 years and it's a good fit, then they have the opportunity to onboard into co-ownership. So they would buy in with about $5,000, and they would be a co-owner, co-decision maker, of our farm. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Because that was one of the questions I had, is like, how long do you feel like you need to work with someone before you feel comfortable with them, you know, being a part owner? Because that's a big deal.
It's like being married to each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, pretty much. Yes. Because business core just goes through all aspects. There's so many different aspects of it. Talk a little bit about then how you structure your week on the farm. What does that look like?
Yeah, totally. So we have, over the years, we're in our 8th year, I think, farming, starting our 8th season, farming together. So we've learned a lot, and we've learned a lot about boundaries in particular. And so, the most important part of our week is that we don't work more than 40 hours. No one person works more than 40 hours in a week. That feels really important and also pretty unique for a vegetable farm.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So on Monday mornings, the whole crew gathers and we take a walk of the farm and we figure out what needs to be done. So we make our to-do list for the week and everyone's on the same page. And, we sell at farmers market twice a week, in May through October. So, we have that means we have two harvest days and 2 days that someone goes out and vends. Mostly we just work 8 to 4:30 during the growing season, and one person is our livestock manager, and we rotate who does chores on the weekends and also who does the Saturday farmers market.
Okay. Yes.
And so, you know, whoever's doing chores on the weekends takes time out in the week before so that they don't work more than 40 hours. But yeah, that's how we do it. And, we also, at least in years past, have had rotations of like, this week I'm cooking lunch for everybody, all week long. And so we just have a okay. lunch together, and then that rotates who the chef is. So that's also a fun time and a fun way to keep connected to the food that we're growing.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So you actually live on the farm?
Yeah. So the first 5 years, 5 seasons on the farm, I lived in a yurt on the farm, and it got old pretty fast. But
that's so. And cold.
But we ended up being able to build a house, and once our business was like running well enough, the bank was willing to believe us that we would rent out enough rooms to our workers and stuff like that to be able to cash flow a mortgage. So we built a house in 2021 and moved in at the end of the year. And so, yeah, we prioritize workers being able to live in the house, but not everyone wants to live in community. So some people might live in town, and other people live on the farm, and either way, it's great.
Gotcha. So, but you use the aspect to be able to rent the rooms out to give you more mortgage power,
Bankability. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I pay rent to the house. The house is owned by Humble Hands Harvest. And so I pay rent to live in the house, and as does everyone else.
And so then a question is the Humble Hands Harvest set up as an LLC, or what's the business structure actually?
Yeah, we're technically an LLC. We would be a cooperative, except under Iowa code, you need 5 members to be a cooperative. There are just 2 of us right now.
So. Gotcha. Okay. So you technically can't. All right. Gotcha. But it's your operating agreement that basically tells. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Absolutely. All right.
Hello, dear listeners. As the green shoots of spring emerge, signaling planting season in full swing, isn't it the perfect time to bring new life onto the land? At shop.growingfarmers.com, a treasure trove awaits to transform even the most forgotten corner of your space into a vibrant oasis. Imagine lush elderberries and willows swaying in the breeze, or the sweet promise of homegrown strawberries and the hearty depth of rhubarb pie made from your harvest. Perhaps you've pondered over the joy of harvesting your own potatoes. Well, ponder no more. Our small business is dedicated to bringing you an exceptional variety of plant material to make these dreams a reality. We're shipping daily, ensuring that your planting ambitions are supported with timely and quality deliveries right to your doorstep. So if you've been eyeing that sunny spot by the fence, or considering how to fill that quiet corner of your yard, look no further. Our perennial selections are not just plants. They're future harvests, memories, and the beginning of a more sustainable lifestyle right from your own land. Visit shopgrowingfarmers.com today and make the first step towards a greener, more fruitful farmstead or garden. We can't wait to grow with you.
Talk a little bit through kind of like maybe what are some of the more challenges that you've kind of had to work through or that have come up that you figured out along the way of this business structure?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges that we've had to work through is different working styles and different needs out of what we want out of the business. Like, for example, I love big picture thinking. I love engaging in community. And that means that sometimes I have a meeting that's in the middle of a work day and whatever. And so I want to do that. And Emily's much more of a routine focused and like tangible focused person. And so sometimes that gets frustrating between us. that's
because she's like, why aren't you out helping weed the carrots?
Exactly. Yeah.
okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've had enough years together to know that this is a dynamic, and we've both accepted and kind of compromised in that way. Like I know that I my being consistent and my being available is important to Emily. And she knows that my being able to be spontaneous and being able to go and do these other things is really important to me. So we care for each other as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. No, my brother and I started working together when we were 16 and 17 with our first farm, very similar work styles. And the fact that I am more get it done. He was the big picture kind of guy. Uh-huh. We were too young to try to get it actually figured out. So he ended up leaving the business after a couple of years, but I completely understand with mm-hmm. how that has mm-hmm. to, that can be a challenge. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, unfortunately now I'm that person because I'm in the office doing the podcast totally. And all yep. the meetings and stuff. Yes. And new employees be like, yeah, we don't know what Michael does all day. And I was like, right. well, I wish you could see. Yes. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about your marketing. So you do farmers market. How else do you sell your products?
Yeah. So CSA and farmers market is kind of how we started in Decorah. I had that initial kind of restaurant accounts with my first rented farm. That we kept up for a few years. But then we were just realizing that we had enough business just at the farmer's market in Decorah, which is just a town of 8,000 people, uh-huh. a yeah. county of 20,000 people. So not a big place, but we had enough business here that we didn't need to go send our food elsewhere. So that feels really good, to be able to keep everything local and, know most of the people that we're yes. vending to. So farmers market is probably 60% of our business. CSA is probably 20%. And then another 20% is now wholesale through the Iowa Food Hub, which aggregates food and takes it to schools mostly, farm to school okay. stuff, but also some other institutions and restaurants in the region. So that's been really great, to work with them and to help build them up, as an entity.
Yeah. And are they schools getting government money for like a farm to school program?
Yeah. So for the past couple of years, there was a government program, local food to schools, program that was subsidizing each school, you know, several thousand dollars or something like that. And so sometimes that several thousand dollars made a really big difference in rural school districts.
Correct.
So that was a big thing, but it has stopped for the time being. So we'll see how much those schools continue to order locally.
Yeah, I did see something about, that's a federal program, right? That was only for a couple mm-hmm. years. I did mm-hmm. see something about a renew of that. And the article was because I guess Tennessee forgot to get their application in for the renew. And so these like four or five farmers that were selling significant quantities through this are really struggling now because they scaled up for it. So it's kind of unfortunate. But what types of products were you moving through the food hub?
We were moving a lot of root crops. Okay. We've been kind of growing our winter markets and our just storage vegetable kind of things lately. So a lot of root crops in the winter and squash and things like that. But then also in the more shoulder seasons, it's funny because the school year is not correct. Exactly timed with the, mm-hmm. the farming season. But people would take a lot of greens like spinach or lettuce mix or that kind of thing as well.
And how many tunnels do you have on your farm, or do you have tunnels?
We just have one high tunnel that is just a 30 by 72 foot high tunnel. So it's not even very big. But we grow our tomatoes in there in the growing season. We don't really like growing tomatoes that much, so we don't have a large number of them. I think the highlight of the high tunnel for us is overwintering spinach and, yes. and other greens, cilantro also, and then seeding carrots in February so we can get some nice May carrots or June carrots, depending.
Yeah.
We like the high tunnel to kind of keep us keep us interested in the winter. And then most of our production is just in the field.
Okay. And then what type of soil do you have?
Yeah. So we have heavy clay soil, and after years, decades of it being tilled for corn, we basically had no topsoil when we started on the farm. So one of the really interesting things we've done in the past few years is we made a conversion to no-till practices.
Okay. So
our entire vegetable field is now in kind of raised no-till beds. And we did that mostly initially because springs were so wet and our soil was such heavy clay that we couldn't get into the ground to till, like, in any kind of consistent way. And so we couldn't plant, because we were relying on tillage for planting. And so when we just kind of took the tillage element out of the system, that means a lot more like, hand labor, to clean up the field, and that kind of thing. But it also means that we can plant whenever we want to, basically in the spring, or all year round. And so that feels like kind of a worthwhile trade-off, especially with our no-till system. We're applying compost and really noticing improvements in the soil too. So,
okay. So kind of walk us through a little bit, like, how does a crop cycle work in your no-till system?
Yeah. I guess one of the more important things that we've like realized as we've developed this system is that tarps are amazing for our purposes. So what we try to do, the ideal situation would be that we would cover crop a space in the fall, tarp it in the spring, and then kind of have that cover crop mulch that is either killed by the winter or by the tarp, and then be able to plant directly into that. So either direct seeding, we just make a furrow with a hoe and direct seed into that mulch, and then cover it over with compost, or we cover the bed with compost first and then transplant into that.
Okay.
So we put just, you know, maybe an inch or a half inch of compost over the bed, spread it over. And then the crop grows, we harvest it, and then we take any, you know, big debris, like if it's a tomato, we take the vine out of the field and put it in our compost pile. And if there's not much debris, then we can just cover crop again and tarp the couple weeks before we're ready to plant the next thing into it.
Okay, so the tarps are key for you. And then I'm assuming the quality of the compost you have must be excellent.
Yeah, it's purchased compost from a dairy farm, organic dairy. Mm-hmm.
That's good. Okay, and then what would you say one of the biggest challenges in moving into that system has been for you?
Yeah, the labor reallocation, I guess, because it has meant that weeds, the way it's worked out is that there's less weeding to do in the middle of the season, but there's a lot more work to do to get the crop into the ground. That's been interesting to just kind of reorient our brains around the flow of everything. But other than that, it's been a pretty nice system. I mean, both Emily and I really value like working with our bodies over tractor machinery stuff. Okay. So it's not for everyone. Like if you really love using a tractor, then, you know, go for it.
Yeah.
Both of us just like moving tarps around and using hose and things like that. So
do you use any landscape fabric?
We haven't done much with landscape fabric. I just never was on a farm that used it when I was learning. So I haven't been interested
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. All right. So talk to us a little about, you do some education and kind of encouragement in the farming community. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I think the most important thing that we've done as a farm is to start the Queer Farmer Convergence. Mm-hmm. So I, as a queer person in a rural Midwestern place, was feeling pretty isolated. And we figured out, me and a friend basically said, hey, like, we can find other queer people who want to be engaged in farming. And so we initiated this kind of gathering of called the Queer Farmer Convergence that happened on our farm first in 2018. And yeah, over the years that has kind of blossomed into an actual like Queer Farmer Network that has a website, queerfarmernetwork.org, and various other convergences are happening in other parts of the Midwest, mostly at this point, but also the South. And so that's really exciting to have kind of built this network of people. So it's not necessarily a group of, it's not like technical farming stuff as much as it is just kind of social support and solidarity. But it's been really incredible and amazing to be to be part of that, of growing that.
Very cool. So do you do any other education through conferences or anything like that?
Yeah. Okay. I definitely speak at conferences, and we love doing field days on our farm and having people out and just showing what we're doing. It's a really interesting thing to transition from like beginning farmer, baby farmer to like, oh, now I have something to say to people.
Yeah.
So that's been fun to realize that in the past couple of years.
I've made that mistake twice, so I can tell you how I fixed it. Cool. What would you say for a beginning farmer who's just thinking about getting into farming? What kind of advice would you give them?
Yeah. I think the main advice that I have for people is to, like, the land access piece is so hard. And so really investing in like the community, like the people of the community that you want to be in feels to me like the best way to actually be able to access land and be able to be supported when you're on that land. So that feels really important to me, to just like say, hey, you got to connect with the people around you. But then also just remembering that like this work that we're doing of growing food is incredibly important work. And like sometimes the systems that make it so hard to enter farming make it feel like no one understands that. And so I just think it's really important that people know that like we all, as farmers, we all understand that it's really important and we want more farmers to join.
Yeah. I would differentiate that and say that people in a sustainable agricultural movement believe that, because unfortunately I feel a lot of resistance sometimes from the conventional crowd of new people starting because they're taking land that they should be, the old guard should be farming. So we experienced that last year in a pretty significant way, which was, I mean, sad, but also just kind of shows you the state of our food system.
Right. Totally.
But you're absolutely right. I think any of us farmers, we just want more people doing it because we just know how important it is and how much better the food is for people eating it. What would you go back and say to yourself if you could, for like your first year of farming? What advice would you give yourself?
Well, just like give yourself grace to mess up and not know what's going on and just learn as you go. Don't expect perfection right away, but expect learning.
Okay. That's good advice. All right. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on today. Appreciate your time and hope that you have a wonderful growing season this year.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you.
So
there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.